Good to see each one here this morning. We appreciate the presence of all. And it is good to have Ryder back from college and have Oren and Aubrey here visiting with us. Glad that you are all here. This morning I want to talk about walls, and the title of the lesson is Watching the Walls. You know, a wall can be a help or a hindrance, depending on which side of it you are, or the situation that you are in. When I told Seth what I was going to talk about, he mentioned, I hadn't even thought about Fair and Young's song, Hello Walls. Well, that's what came to his mind, and I hadn't thought about it. I guess I should have thought about it when I was preparing this lesson. But the Bible has a lot to say about this, and I want us to go through several instances where this is important, and to get the lesson, or lessons, some of them, from the context of these discussions. The walls. For example, in this first one, we have talked about in our Bible class on Sunday morning, a couple of Sundays ago, starting in Exodus 13, verses 21 and 22, you think about the walls of water. I had Seth lead that song just then because it indicates deliverance. God has delivered me. And what you're reading about in Exodus 13 are the walls of deliverance. When God has Israel march through on dry ground with a wall of water on either side. Imagine if you were one of the Israelites, and maybe an Israelite child, and you're marching through that. You think one of the kids might have poked his hole in the water? It's a wall, but it's water. Mama, it's water, but it's a wall of water. How does God do that? Two walls of water, that wind caused that, dried out the ground, and it represents deliverance. Deliverance from slavery. Deliverance from tyranny, from Pharaoh, from all that's evil in the past. And now you're going to be, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, 1 and 2, baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And the sea was there by the two walls, the walls of water. And the cloud was on top, and we talked a couple of Sundays ago about that cloud representing the presence of God. And how that it seems very, very possible in the light of the fact that in 1 Corinthians 10 it is set up as a type of New Testament baptism. Well, we know what the water is, but the cloud represented God. God there. You're being baptized, you know, in water and in God unto Moses. And if the type is complete, yeah, that would seem to represent what Jesus was saying in John 3, 3 through 5, born of water. And what about the cloud? Born of spirit. That's what it looks like to me, even though I'm not being dogmatic about it right now. Another interesting thing is, in Leviticus 16, verses 1 and 13, as we talked about in our Bible class, you remember on the Day of Atonement, from the altar of incense, just outside the veil, the incense burned, and a cloud was formed that came over the curtain and came into the inner sanctuary. And a lot of that evidently was right there on the propitiatory, the mercy seat. And God told Moses, I will meet with the high priest in the cloud. Now that's the cloud from the altar of incense. But that's not the cloud in Exodus 13. That's not the cloud in the type of deliverance. That's the type of our baptism. That cloud came from above. Amazing. But at any rate, as they came through and they passed through successfully and landed on the other side, and then those walls collapsed. By the power of God. Depends on where you are in reference to a wall. Whether it's good for you or whether it now becomes your judge, your point of condemnation. Think of all the people of all the time that have resisted the walls of deliverance, turned down the way of deliverance, the way of salvation, and they've manufactured other ways of escape, they think. They have tried to cross ground in other places, they have done, but it was all futile attempt. All futile attempt. By faith, Hebrews 11:29, by faith these things were done. At any rate, there were the walls of water. Number two. Secondly, you think about the walls of Jericho. Joshua chapter 6. Those walls that came tumbling down. And you can't help, as you study that in detail, and we've done some of that in our ladies' Bible class. We've talked about how that, you know, for 7 days there was this strategy employed by God that the armed men move around the walls in silence. And then finally, you know, they blow the trumpet. They shout with a loud voice. And God says, I'm telling you, those walls are going to come down. And for all those days, they can't see a crack in it. They can't see that this is doing anything. It certainly doesn't seem like sensible strategy from a purely human point of view. God said, walk around, do it for so many days, be quiet, and then shout, then blow the trumpet on a given day, and lo and behold, but they did have faith. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed 7 days. Great lesson there. But imagine, just like you try to imagine a wall of water. Imagine the armed men moving about in faith. And don't you know that each day they're looking at those walls and maybe those faces that are peering at them from the walls? And maybe somebody say, when they got back, did you see any change in the walls? Did you see any break in the structure anywhere? Not today, I didn't. Wonder what's going to happen. How's it going to be accomplished? And God finally destroyed the walls. Of course, fighting had to be done. They still had to use the sword to take the people. But they had access to the enemy by the power of God that brought the walls down. The lesson, one lesson is the walls of the enemy are no match for the power of God. I don't care whether it's Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, practice a current Judaism, humanism, existentialism, whatever it is. There is no match. No, there's no match out there for the divine power of God who knows how in every case to bring walls down. It's the God that opens and shuts the doors. It's the God who allows to stand or collapses the walls. That's God. That's God's business. It's not my business, but it's His business. The third case comes from Daniel chapter 5. If you have your Old Testament, you might look at Daniel chapter 5. It's also an interesting illustration of how that we simply don't learn the lessons of history, even recent history. Because just before Daniel chapter 5, you had the sad history of Nebuchadnezzar, who had been one of God's servants. He used Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, to come in and destroy Israel and to deport them as captives because his family turned against him. His family didn't listen to his word. They didn't respect his will. They became worshippers of false gods. They practiced immorality, and God took them away. He gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And then, even after he did that, Nebuchadnezzar, instead of realizing what had happened, got pompous and lifted up in his own mind, and God made him turned him into a beast of the field. Until you know that I give the kingdoms to whomsoever I will. You see, a president or a prime minister or a czar or someone who's in charge with a lot of money and a lot of people and a lot of land, a lot of territory and a lot of guns. If you're not careful, you kind of get lifted up in your own estimation. Well, and Nebuchadnezzar, as he looked out at Babylon, said, oh, look at what I've done. And before long, he was out there on all fours, and he looked like a beast. And his hair grew long. He was unkempt. And he was a madman, out there like an animal, until he finally was able to understand, I did that for you, Nebuchadnezzar. You didn't do it for me. I did it for you. And then you act like, look what I've done. And now his son, after Nebuchadnezzar comes back and understands the lesson, his son doesn't get the lesson, or at least doesn't learn it long. For in time, you know, he has a great feast for a lot of his government employees. And one thing they do, they bring out these vessels that they can drink in that have been taken out of the temple at Jerusalem. When they took all the people back over here to Babylon, you know, they ransacked the area and got the gold and the silver and all of that. And these vessels that were used for eating or drinking, they got all of those. And they took them back. 2 Kings 24:13 is a reference to that. And so they bring out these vessels to drink in. And while they've got these vessels from the temple of God over here now, and Belshazzar has not learned the lesson of his father, and they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of brass, of iron, of wood and stone. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. This is our next wall. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And of course, he's troubled. He can't read he doesn't know what it means. He calls in all of his wise men, tell us what it means, and they don't know. And a woman, the queen, comes in and says, there's a man here in the kingdom that can do that for you. Daniel can tell you what it means. And Daniel is brought in. He says, Daniel, if you can do this, I'll give you this and this and make you third ruler of the kingdom. He says, I'll keep your gifts. I don't need that. But I will tell you what it means. When you come down to verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. This is the writing that was written. Many, many, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Many, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. He's grateful for the information. But then in verse 30 and 31, that night he's killed. Your kingdom is finished. Your days are numbered. He didn't tell him how numbered, how soon. And that night he died. And what he had seen was a non-connected hand writing on the wall. And I want this to be suggestive to us that it represents the fact that God's will is going to be done. His purposes are going to be served in the benefit of those who would be saved. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, they came and they went. The Medes and the Persians came along, and Cyrus would later decree the Jews can go back home if you want to. But it's all according to God's large picture of redemption. And this hand saying that, well, you've had your time, you've had your place, you're on your way out, God's will be done. You ever thought about, and you have, we're just here for a little while, in this century, and then we're leaving. Well, that's what he did. That's what my granddad did, my daddy did, and that's what yours have done, and that's what we're going to do. Now, I hope we're on, and I want us to be on God's side, but our days are numbered. And the things of which we are a part and to which we give our lives will be finished, in a sense. And we're going on to face our record. But God's will is going to be accomplished, regardless of the part you played and whether or not you were a helper or a hinderer. The writing on the wall is clear. You can't stop this. There's no way to impede it. If you want to help, you want to serve, that's one thing. You want to get in the way, that's another. No big deal to God. People need to look at that wall, the plastered wall that Belshazzar saw and caused him some concern, because I don't know what to make of it. How many people and in self-evaluation can say the same thing? I don't know what to make of this. I've been to school and studied philosophy. I studied a lot of things. I still don't know what to make of life. I studied government. I studied civics. I studied history. I studied a lot of things. I don't know what to make of this. You're just here for a while, man. You better get it figured out pretty soon. Your days are numbered. And your life's almost finished when it starts. And you're going to have to face how you lived on this earth. The wall with the writing on it. The fourth one is the wall at Jerusalem. Jerusalem. You know the Jews gloried in the walls of Jerusalem. The book of Nehemiah and Esther, you know, have to do with the resettling of Israel after the Babylonian captivity. They come back. And Nehemiah comes back and works on the wall. And you go to Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 6. Here's where the king allowed him to leave Babylon and go back. You come over to chapter 4 and verse 6. And notice, so built we the wall. And all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. I've heard my daddy preach sermons on that. Probably heard it several times. The people had a mind to work. And he's working on the wall. And then in chapter 6, Sanballat tries to stop all the work. Gets it stopped for a while. In fact, when you count it all up, it looks like it was quite a few years. But then it gets going again. And you get over to chapter 6 and verse 1 and chapter 15 and 16. They finish the whole thing. They finish the whole thing. If you go back over to Ezekiel chapter 8, I want you to see something with me over there. Well, if I can find Ezekiel. Chapter 8. I want you to see something here that happens. When God finally allowed the Babylonians to come in and break down the walls necessary to their entry so that they could overcome the populace and start deporting people to Babylon, He allowed that to go on, you know, for a while. And they would make deportations. And some people were still over here in Palestine where the first ones deported are over there in Babylon. Ezekiel gets deported over there. And he settles with some Jews over there by the river Kibar. And God wants him to see some things about why this all happened. And in the spirit, verse 3, he's taken in vision back to Jerusalem. And God wants him to see what is still going on over there and what sins had been committed over there, which caused God to allow His holy city to be overrun by all of these pagans. And so in vision, he's taken back to Jerusalem. Look at verse 7. And he brought me to the door of the court. And when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. You've heard of the hole in the wall gang? Butch Cassidy and his people? The hole in the wall. He showed me a hole in the wall. Then said he unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said, Go in and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. Said, Ezekiel, I wanted you to get a view of actually what Israel has been doing, which has provoked my wrath to the point of allowing deportations back to Babylon. So he starts looking. I went in and saw, verse 10, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. You know, you've gone into caves out here and you've seen Indian writings or figures, you know. My goodness, look at that. And he's in here looking here on the wall, right here in Jerusalem. Images that have to do with their stupid idolatry. God's center, God's headquarters on earth in Israel. The temple of God here. Idolatrous images on the wall. Ezekiel says, I saw that. And there stood before them 70 men of the elders or ancients. And you know, they had censers like they were worshiping. Look at verse 12. Then said he unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Put number one by that. Here's your first scene. What they do in the dark. Every man in the chambers of his imagination. For they say, the Lord seeth us not. The Lord hath forsaken the earth. That's the way a lot of people live. Religious, the religion we've been practicing is no good. He said unto me also, and look, this is number two, verse 13. Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Now that's a Greek god of the Babylonians, Phoenicians, and Assyrians. And these women, the women of Israel, are crying out. They're crying for this god, this fiction, you know, to help them. Oh, Tammuz, Tammuz. That's not quite like Jehovah, is it? You lose your sight. You lose your perspective. These are God's people. Oh, Tammuz. Now, thirdly, verse 15. Then he said, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. So you've got all these images on the wall indicative of various forms of idolatry. You've got Tammuz, to whom the women are crying. Now he sees these men, their backs toward the temple. They're not worshiping God. And they're worshiping the sun. Stupid. Dumb. Unnecessary. But it's headstrong, stubborn people who refuse to walk in the ways of God. There's an expression there at the end of verse 17. It's kind of peculiar. Lo, they put the branch to their nose. That's kind of hard to... Some scholars have found in the days of the Persians that when they worshiped, sometimes the men would, as they worshiped the sun, the Persians would sometimes hold twigs in their left hand, and the priest would put a veil over the mouth of the worshipers lest their breath contaminate the rays of the sun while they worshipped him. Now, this evidently has some sort of a reference to something like that, that they're covering up or they're doing something as they worship the sun. Pitiful! How many things you get into, how much nonsense gets practiced when you forsake the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. But anyway, that happened to Ezekiel. He got a picture of that as he dug through the hole in the wall at Jerusalem. Now, what's a point we could say? God abandons the walls. He abandons His people in times of idolatry. In reference to Nehemiah, he repairs the walls when the people are ready to return. You know, there are a lot of congregations, several congregations that have already abandoned the cause of God. They're apostate churches. They're lost causes. The walls are down. Other places may just be weak and in need of great repair. Many lives could be like that. Maybe a life is completely lost, or a life that's it's been hurt, it's been wounded, it's gone astray, but it's now on the verge of maybe getting a little bit of will to come back. God knows how to abandon a wall. God knows how to repair a wall. Now, what kind of wall do you have? What kind of wall do you want? What kind of wall is in your experience? Number five, right quickly. 1 Samuel 31 and verse 10. Sad thing happens to Saul and Jonathan and Abinadab and another very obscure son of Saul that's named there. Saul loses his life in a battle with the Philistines, and so do his three sons, including Jonathan. Saul had his ups and downs in Israel. Saul was in and out, given sanity. Saul was jealous of David. The first king rejected because he rejected God, but he kept on living for a while. And he would fight the Philistines. He would fight God's enemies, even though in heart he had partially turned away too. But he's, in this chapter, fighting the Philistines, part of God's enemies again. And in the battle, he dies. And Jonathan and another son are killed as well. Melchishua. 1 Samuel 31:2. These boys are killed with him. How would you like to have been Jonathan? Let me ask you this. Here's a righteous, God-fearing, father-loving son. And all that he meant to David, and their hearts were joined together. They were like one soul in a way. They loved each other to death. But given the way that Saul was, and the moment of history in which they were caught, they knew they couldn't stay together. But Jonathan knew God was giving the kingdom to his friend David. And here's his father that's lost it. And Jonathan has to stay with his father. How'd you like to have been Jonathan? Caught between a rock and a hard place. But he's always faithful to God. He never excuses his father. Never turns away from God as far as the reports come. And yet, he respects and he goes with his father as far as he can possibly go. And he still fights the battles of his father. And he dies with him on the battlefield. There's a hero. There's a great man. But he loses his life. And Abinadab and Melchishua, they lose their lives this day too. And the Philistines, when they're going over the battleground, they find Saul and his three sons, and they take Saul's armor and they cut his head off, and they began to circulate the army armor among certain cities. And so there they are. And it's such a sad end. It's a sad end. And then they take the bodies of Saul and his boys and they nail it, or they hang it. They hang it up. They fasten it to the wall of Beth Shan. They fasten it to the wall of Beth Shan. Now I'm sure that was a horrible image. A horrible image. And when the valiant men of a town called Jabesh-Gilead learn of where the bodies are, they go one night over there to Beth Shan. Valiant, courageous men. And they don't care who's going to be there, what they're going to face. They get those bodies down. They take the bodies back to Jabesh-Gilead and they burn them and bury the bones. They burn the bodies and bury the bones. This is 2 Samuel 21:12-14. And then later, David, when he hears about it, he has the bones relocated back to the family cemetery. One interesting thing is, right at the end of that, after David does that, the text says, then was God entreated for the land. And what had happened just before the account of the battle with the Philistines, we are told that Saul had put to death some of the Gibeonites. You know, when the Israelites first came into the land, those people that tricked them into thinking that they were from a long way off. And when it was found out they weren't from a long way off, they made them hewers of wood and drawers of water. They made a covenant with them. We'll not kill you. You can stay with us. You'll be our slaves. We're not going to put anybody to death. Made a covenant. But right before we have the battle, and before we have this about the bodies at Beth Shan, Saul somewhere along had killed some of the Gibeonites. And all of that's in this setting right here. And after Saul dies, and his sons die, and their bodies are burned, and the bones are buried, and then the bones are relocated at the family cemetery, then God says, it's settled. It's settled. The wall of Beth Shan. When I think about that, I wonder where in any kind of analogous instance I might play a part in life. I'm just wanting us to think about maybe a practical lesson. Where could I come in an event like this? We don't have anything exactly like it. Don't misunderstand me. But if you were in some sort of historical moment in a situation like this where God's will is being played out, definitely so, and you're one of the characters involved in the scene, who would you be? Would you be someone like Saul that had already expressed his disobedience to God? Would it be somebody like that? Would it be somebody like Jonathan, who knew how to balance his devotion to God and his friendship with David with his respect for a father who's sometimes right and sometimes wrong and sometimes sane and sometimes insane? Would you be like the Philistines, who overcome and gloat in their victories over God's people and hang bodies up and take heads off of faithful people? Would you be like the valiant men of Jabesh-Gilead, who get to a point in life when they say, it doesn't matter who tries to stop us. It's not right for our king's body to be on that wall. And they go and they get it down. There's something to be said for raw determination and nerve, courage to do the right thing in the right way at the right time. Would it be somebody like that? Would it be like the men who take the bones and bury them in the cemetery and maybe have a small service over them? I don't know what they did. And say, well, the bones made it back to his family plot. That's good, at least. Maybe some meditation goes on, some thought. Would you be somebody that simply buries the bones? Where would I come in? It's interesting to think about it because there are all kinds of characters and various events that are involved in the accounts that God gives us. When you think of the wall of Bethshan, you think about Saul and Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishiah hanging there. And they had been a part of God's people. Horrible to think of it. There are other walls that we didn't get to, but that's enough for right now. Watching the walls. We need to learn the lessons of so many situations that God has taught us that involve the walls. May God help us to learn the lessons while we live, to live in the light of the lessons learned, to be grateful for the fact we've had time to learn them, to live and die with them. If you're here this morning and not a Christian, come in faith. Repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, I encourage you to come back right now. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?